Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is WebSphere Message Broker, Message Flow Design Strategies and Usual Pitfalls. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's session, we will start off by introducing to you our panel of experts. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to WebSphere Message Broker, Message Flow Design Strategies, and Usual Pitfalls. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us through email. Then, we will open the lines for live Q&A period. And finally, the session will end with a summary of today's webcast. Moving on to slide number 3. At this time, I would like to introduce our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Tim Deng, WebSphere Message Broker Performance Architect.
Hello, everybody. My name is Tim Deng. I am been working in message broker development now for about 15 years. I've been with IBM for about 20 years, so my primary role is to look after the performance of the product as it's being developed.
Thank you, Tim. Next, we have David Coles, WebSphere Message Broker Level 3 Service Specialist.
Hi, everybody. I'm David Coles. I work in Hersey in the WebSphere Message Broker Level 3 team. I've worked in the team now for 6 or 7 years, and so I'm quite experienced on the product, and so hopefully we'll be able to give you some good education today.
Thank you, David. Then we have David Critton, WebSphere Message Broker Level 3 Service Specialist.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm work with the other Dave you just heard from in L3 dealing with PMRs and customer problems. I've been in the team 5 years and I specialise in JMS and file processing.
Thank you, David. Next, we have Randy Mueller, WebSphere Message Broker Level 2 Specialist.
Hey everyone, Randy Mueller here. I've been with IBM a little over 30 years, last 10 of it here in Message Broker Level 2 support. I'm actually positioned here in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's a beautiful day today. Specialize in issues related to broker on ZOS. Thanks.
Thank you, Randy. And finally, we have Ralph Nanduri, WebSphere Message Broker Level 2 Specialist.
Hi, I'm Ralph. I'm with Level 2 Technical Support with Message Broker for the last 5 years or so. The day-to-day work involves addressing the customer reported problems on different aspects of Message Broker. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. Now, before we get to the question and answer period, our panel would like to give you an overview of the topic. Moving on to slide number 4, and please go ahead, Tim.
Right, thank you. We'll be looking at a number of different aspects of Message Broker, so some to do with runtime performance, some idea, questions around common message flows, how can you put nodes together and connect them into a single flow. Some techniques processing large messages, caching of data, for example, execution group specific profiles. That's quite a range, but sort of with a bias really towards performance and optimization. So the early part of the session really is going to be led by questions that you have previously submitted. And then once we've gone through those, then we'll be opening up the lines later for live questions. So you may want points of clarification around the questions that we've gone through, or you, of course, may have new questions that you want to ask us. So in all of this, we're going to assume, really, that you have a good working knowledge of Message Broker. The presentation is very much sort of about optimization and using particular techniques. So it's not an introduction session. So we will assume that you're quite familiar with broker flow development, you know, configuration of an operation of the product. Thank you, Joseph. Here we go to 4 or 5. So let's get on with our first question. So, the question was, what is the best way to find out why my message flow is slow or why it's taking lots of CPU? Those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. Of course, it could be slow and taking lots of CPU, but often, if something's slow, it tends maybe to be waiting. So, but let's try and get into the question a little bit more. So I could ask for the next foil, please. But there can be a whole variety of reasons why a message flow runs slowly, or a series of message flows, and I've got some of them listed at the top. So probably first and foremost might be lack of CPU, or maybe an excessive amount of processing for the CPU that is available. So basically, you know, the machine's running at 100%, you can't do anything. And there can be a number of reasons for that, and we'll go into some of those a little bit later. Another one might be that you're calling out to a service. You know, maybe you're doing a web service call, or you're doing some message flow aggregation using the aggregation nodes. So you're making calls or requests to other services outside the message broker flow, and for some reason, those services that you're calling are themselves being slow. And so this, of course, will impact the message flow performance. So although, you know, people say, why is broker running slow? You may often find that actually it's not broker, it's the service that's been invoked from it. Another reason could be that the system maybe has very high memory usage, and there's a lot of paging on the system. So basically the system sort of got itself into a state where it's thrashing, you know, it doesn't know whether to page or run something. Another one could be that trace is turned on. Trace is very useful, but there are times to use it and times not. And when you're trying to do some performance work, that's not a good time to have trace on. So you need to make sure that it's not on. And look not only at the message flow, but also at the execution group level to make sure that it's not on. And it may well be that there are, you know, that broker's fine. You know, it's behaving well. It's not using an excessive amount of CPU. But, you know, there are other things on there. You know, and often a common one is that you get a database on there, for example. Not necessarily a broker database, but it could be containing business data. And it itself, you know, requires a lot of memory or a lot of CPU or is taking a lot of I.O. capacity. So that's, you know, imagine for a moment we have our problem and we need some way to get into it. And, you know, it's quite tricky to sort of pry the thing open and try and dig in and understand where the problem is. So it's no good sort of trying to rely on intuition. You know, there are times when that's right, you know, when you're choosing a partner, for example. But when you're actually trying to debug a problem in a system like this, you really need to use tools. And there's a whole variety that we could use, and we probably need to use multiple of them. I think, first of all, what we need to do is understand what's happening at the system level. So, you know, on Unix, for example, you'd use tools like VMstat to see whether the system was paging, whether there's a lot of I.O. going on, whether you're using a lot of CPU. Windows has its own tools, things like Process Explorer, Task Manager. ZOS has a great collection of tools, very detailed. For SDSF, very quick view. But, you know, data like SMF will give you a, you know, very good level of detail about the amount of CPU and memory being used by address spaces. So really, you can use these tools to get a quick insight into what the machine as a whole is doing and what the execution groups of the data flow engine executables are doing on the machine. You usually get a pretty good idea whether you're using lots of CPU or whether the thing's just sat there stalled. So once you get some idea of where it is you need to put your focus, then you can start to use product-specific tools like MQ Explorer to look at queue depth, or use MQ Trace, for example. MQ has its own accounting and statistics. And then, you know, if the issue is in message broker in the actual flow, then you can use things like accounting and statistics and resource statistics. You may also be using Java code in your message flows, and the Java Health Center is very good for allowing you to see what's happening in the JVM that runs within each execution group. Next foil, please. Thank you. So I've put here a list of common performance problems. So often the problem is not with the flow itself, may not be around the operation of the flow. Sometimes it can be the development of it. Sometimes it can be the way it's configured. So probably top of our list of the problems I see are where we're spending too much CPU time doing parsing. Trace I mentioned, maybe the runtime configuration, maybe there's too much configured on the machine. There are specific things you can do around transport tuning, and we document some of that in our performance reports, which are out on the web. There are issues around your test methodology, for example. You know, it's much better to have sustained throughput rather than put 5,000 or 10,000 messages on a queue. So if you could go to portal 8, please. A really good way of looking at what's happening within the broker is to use message broker accounting and statistics facility, and also new in V7 are the resource statistics. So this diagram sort of neatly shows you the level at which these two work. So accounting and statistics allows you to see what's happening in the flow, but also down to the node and the terminal level. And that information can be aggregated up so you can see what, you know, how many instances you've allocated, how busy those are, and have a look at how all your execution groups are doing, whether one's busier than the other. That's very useful for actual flow specifics. And then the resource statistics are very good for allowing you to see what the execution group as a whole is doing. So you can see what's happening in the JVM, for example, and see how many connections have been opened, that type of thing. Could we go on to the next foil, please? So in this foil, I have some examples. So on the left-hand side, I've got some accounting and statistics, and on the right-hand side, I've just got an example of some visual statistics. So this data is presented in Message Broker Explorer. So you can go and get the data, this data as XML messages, but a really easy way to view this data is to use the facilities in Message Broker Explorer that came in version 7. These allow you to collect snapshot statistics, and so you can really very quickly get an idea as to who's using most of its CPU, and then, you know, find that flow or that execution group that's really busy and drill down into that, find out which nodes are using most CPU, so you can really get a quick handle. And then, especially where, you know, we're talking about things like slow services, you can see, you know, maybe an HTTP request node in a flow has a very long elapsed time. You know, that probably tells you that the issue is to do with the service that's being invoked rather than the flow. But can we go on to port 10, please? I just thought it would be worth mentioning, you know, where the main processing costs arise. So when you do have performance problems with your message flow, if you find it's using an excessive amount of CPU, then the areas in which you tend to look would be, you know, if you're using too much parsing or you are not using the latest parsers. So for XML, for example, you'd use the XML NFC domain. With tree navigation, you can get very large, complex trees if you've got large messages, maybe many elements, many depths to that. So you can incur quite a lot of extra CPU around tree navigation. Message tree copying, where you've got lots of compute nodes, is a pretty expensive operation because it is a copy of a complex object. So also, if you have a high level of resource access, you're going to database loss, or you're putting a large result set, or you're doing lots of operations on queues, for example, then you can get a lot of resource usage from that. And then also you should look at the efficiency of your processing logic. And there are guidelines around sort of documenting how to produce efficient message flow. So we have support packs, for example, on the Message Broker website. Okay, so that concludes our sort of quick look at how you can drill down into performance, how you in the different areas in which you might get overhead. Could we move to foil 11, please? But so that second question is, can we have one message flow with MQ input node, JMS input node, SOAP input node, and HTTP input node, followed by a compute node, i.e. a message flow, which can take input on different protocols? If yes, are there any limitations we should be aware of? So the answer is yes, you can do it. So if you can go on to coil 12, then we can have a look at some examples of different ways to do this. So in the top left-hand corner there, I have a copy of a flow, which takes the input from the nodes directly wires them to a compute node. I can sort of compare that with the one immediately below that. And so you can see different styles of doing this processing. And so you can do this, you can put them together. There are a number of issues that we need to be aware of, and we'll cover those in a moment. The sort of third style you could have is in the top right-hand corner, where you have each input source has its own sequence of nodes, and those nodes all together could be in a single flow. So like parallel streams of processing, but all contained within the same flow. Can we go on to foil 13, please? Right, so a number of issues really around common flow design. So it may well be that you have different styles of interaction from your different types of transport nodes. Some may be working in a point-to-point style or publish-subscribe. Some of those may have different availability requirements. So they may be supporting different services, for example. And you may, some of those may need to be available. It's very difficult to stop half a message flow. So that would be a reason for putting those different transports in different flows, because they can then start to stop them, operate them, redeploy them individually. There will be differences at the development runtime level also. So those different nodes will have different transport headers, for example, require, they'll provide information to you with different fields and require, different information to be set for an outgoing message using those transports. Now, and in some cases, you need to retain the original context, like an MQ reply to queue manager or queue, for example, and, with it. HTTP nodes, for example, then you have this reply identifier that's required so we can identify the connection to reply on. But there will also be issues around deployment. So some transports, for example, like the HTTP broker-wide listener can only support a single port. So you may want to think about how you deal with that. You couldn't put a node that was using the broker-wide listener in many flows or execution groups, and deploy that widely. There would need to be a single instance of it. But also you need to think about how you allocate message flow instances. There are differences, as the sort of graphics on the right-hand side show, as to how you allocate extra instances. And you can find that if you start allocating extra instances at the flow level, not at the individual node level, then you can get thread starvation, and you'll get more messages coming in from some transports rather than others, and so it can be unbalanced. Right, thank you. That's a couple of questions there. So there's a question, which is better performance, multiple inputs in one flow or different flows? Well, really, there's no hard and fast rule about that. So each input node has its own thread or pool of threads. So they're able to run side by side or in different flows. But I think probably for ease of management, then you may want to keep those separate rather than try and put everything in a small number of flows. If we comment on use of user-defined nodes and performance,
I think that's talking about the user-defined nodes that are subflows.
Right.
And they're very much the same as normal subflows. They just appear as a user-defined node in your palette. So it'll be the same performance as a normal message flow there. It's compiled when you compile the message flow. The user-defined subflow message flows will be put into the main message flow and will be deployed down or perform as a normal message flow would. So subflows are very much, at the moment, a design time thing and not a runtime entity.
Thank you. We'll now move on to question number 2 and 3 on slide number 14.
Hi, thank you, Joseph. David Cole here. So yes, the question, we had a couple of questions here on, is there a sandbox environment which we can sort of play in and learn more about WebSphere Message Broker? And also, are there any good how-to websites for WebSphere Message Broker? And the answer to both of those is very much a yes. So if you can move on to slide 15, then we'll briefly touch on some of those different types of resources here. So in answer to this sandbox environment, you can come and go onto the website and you can download a trial version of WebSphere Message Broker. In fact, most IBM products have trial versions these days. The trial version for Message Broker is allows you to install it on your machine for 90 days, and then you can play with that. You can use most of the functionality in the trial version, and you can very much try out all the different transports, the different transformation logic, and all of the other processing actions you can take part in Message Broker flows. So, but whilst you're playing, how would you actually go about learning what to try? So we've got the IBM Education Assistant. There's a link there to the Education Assistant Info Center. And in there, there's lots of resources for Message Broker. If you look there, there's some for version 6 and for version 7. And these are videos, screenshots, audio presentations over the top of videos that show people configuring the node, running through the samples, giving demos of the different functionality, or even introducing the new products. So that's a very good resource for watching and listening and watching someone else use it and letting them talk over what they're doing and why they're doing it. So that's the education assistant. And we're very much adding content into that all the time, so keep checking back there as well. The next one down for learning is the Message Broker samples. In Message Broker, there's obviously lots of transports, lots of transformation logic options, and all of those we write samples for, so sample message flows that explain the technology, explain the nodes, talk about the configuration options. And the samples are a really good way to learn and to play, and you can follow the instructions, you can deploy the samples, you can run test messages, and then also at the end of the sample, there's often extensions which allow you to ask you questions on how you might do something yourself, and then you can go away, tweak the sample, see what effect it has, and play through that as well. And whilst you're using the samples, you can use things like the message flow debugger to step through your message flow to see how it works, and all the time you're learning about the product and the different transports. And then the final option there is the developer work site for Message Broker. On there, there's lots of questions about lots of topics about the different things you can use. So there's lots of topics on SOAP, so configuring WS security, presentations there on performance, designing for performance for ZOS, the system customization. There's lots of different topics and documents available on the developer work site for Message Broker, so it's always worth a look. And one of the other things worth talking about is patterns. So that was new in version 7. So there's lots of there's several predefined scenarios inside the Message Broker toolkit. You can go into the toolkit, you can select patterns, perhaps look for something similar to what you're doing, and it will ask you lots of questions, and then patterns will then generate you a message flow that will hopefully attempt to solve your problems. So in the patterns editor, there's lots of explanations around the different patterns, explains the message flows that are developed. And even if you don't want to use patterns, there's still a good resource to look and see, look at some best practices in message flow design. So moving on from slide 15, if we can move on to slide 16, then the next question we had in was, what are the pitfalls for using message flow monitoring to audit and monitor my message flows? So if we move on to slide 17, I'll start talking about monitoring and auditing. And this was a new function added in version 6.1 of Broker and then extended in version 7, which allows you to emit events which may be consumed by Business Monitor or by other products. The events are published, and the events are published when certain things happen in your message flow. So if you receive a message to an input node, you start a transaction, you can emit an event, or you can move between different nodes, and on those terminal connections, you can emit different events as well. So this allows you to monitor and sort of audit your message flow. So, but you have to be very careful with this, because The more events you start emitting, then it could impact the performance, the memory usage on your message flow, and also your infrastructure. So when you emit events, you can choose to put payload in that in those events. So you can choose to pull data out of the message flow, and you can choose to pull out single values or big chunks of message tree. And so you have to think about when you're generating those events, what you actually need to publish and what you actually need to store away for audit and for monitoring purposes. Do you need the entire message, or can you just cope with one field, perhaps like a customer ID or something like that, for audit purposes? So the idea of monitoring and auditing, it's very much not supposed to be a trace of your message flow. So you don't want to go around putting events on every terminal connection that you can. Because if you've got, say, a message flow that's perhaps only 5 nodes, it takes in a very small message, perhaps a less than 1K message, and if you emit 5 or 6 events from that message flow, then your one message will actually turn into 6 messages on the output. So you have to be very careful here that you don't emit too many events. Because if you start emitting 6 events for every one message, how can your MQ infrastructure cope with that? Are you ready to handle that many messages? So be very careful. And also, as they are emitted as messages, then they are sized. And if you start emitting lots of data in your messages, your monitoring messages, then that could also have an effect on your channels, your queues, your logs, anything like that in your MQ infrastructure. So that very much leads into the performance overhead of emitting an event. The more data and the more options you select on your message monitor, then the higher the performance cost for your flow. So again, if you've got a small, quick routing flow that really doesn't do any parsing and you emit 4 events, then it will slow down your message flow. So it's something to be aware of when turning on monitoring and auditing. If we move on to slide 18, then there's some more considerations to think of. So if you're about to log a bitstream or message data, how big is your input message? If you've got a 10 meg input message coming in and you want to log the bitstream of that in a monitoring or auditing event, your monitoring or auditing event is going to be at least 10 meg in size because you've emitted that bitstream inside the event. So how will you process that in Business Monitor? How will your other tools that subscribe to these events process that? So be very careful with what you emit. And also, do you need to emit the bitstream and message content at the same time? If you've got the bitstream, you can probably find the message content at a later date. If you emit the bitstream and some message content, then you are duplicating data, so you can be wary of that. And also, again, do you want to emit the same message content in multiple event messages? So as you go through your flow, do you need to say the same things with each one, perhaps a customer ID or a user ID, which is pulled out of the message? You're going to emit that every time. But actually, monitoring events have a correlation ID on them, which you can select, and which is output on the events to tie all events in one invocation or flow together. So we provide facilities for doing that that perhaps mean you don't need to go looking in the message tree each time you emit an event, just so you can correlate the data. And the final thing to be aware of with monitoring is enabling monitor can affect the behavior of your message flow. So when you turn on a monitoring event and you say, I would like some data from the input message, perhaps you want to emit or go and find a certain field in the message, then you're going to have to parse that message there and then. So in the input node, if you go looking for a message field, the message will be parsed in the input node just so we can go and find the field we want and emit your monitoring event. So because we're parsing the message there, we may fall over some exceptions. So are you ready to handle any exceptions that may be generated from parsing the message at that stage? When you designed your flow initially, you may have designed it with on-demand parsing in mind. So perhaps you knew that 5 nodes in is when you actually need to get to the data, and you're parsing there before, and you have a try and catch node before that, which would catch any exceptions, then you will now parse it before you get there. So you have to be ready to deal with this and think about how enabling monitoring can change where your parsing happens inside your message flow. So we've had a question on the line, which is, What is the best monitoring tool available to monitor performance of message flows without slowing them down?
I think that relates to a previous question perhaps for Tim.
Right, yes. I mean, this is, you have to pay something to find something. So the only way to sort of monitor what's going on at a flow level without actually being intrusive, the only way you could do that would be to sort of watch what's going in and coming out and watch the queue depth, you know, the rate at which they're going down, and that's easy with MQ. But really that is very limited information that that gives you. It just tells you basically whether the thing's working and sort of at the rate. I think really you need to go in to start using accounting and statistics to have a look, because that really gives you a very good breakdown as to what's happening in the message flow. You can aggregate this information so you can see it across all your flows. Snapshot statistics will show you every 20 seconds what's happening. So the overhead is fairly modest. You know, it's a few percent. It's not 20, 30, 40%. So I think considering the information you get, it's very good.
And so we would recommend that you use the message flow accounting and statistics to monitor performance of your message flow and not your event messages, certainly.
Correct. And don't use trace either, because that totally distorts what's going on.
Yeah. So another question we had, is there any way we can find out the status of traces on the broker? There is. There's a new enhancement went into version 7.6 pack 3. We've had the MQSI trace, report trace command, which you used to be able to ask a single message flow or execution group if trace was enabled. The 6 pack 3 version of MQSI report trace, you can now do MQSI report trace and a broker name, and it will report all of the traces that are active on a message broker.
So, good source to learn writing SQL. I think it would be the education system, or the documentation. The samples are very good.
Mm.
So there are a lot of samples in Message Broker now. So if you go into the toolkit, you can import those. You can see the techniques that are used in those samples. So they give you a wide range of node use, how to address the information in those nodes, how to do transformations, all sorts of different technologies, Java, style sheets.
So I think thank you for those questions for the moment. And I think we'll just move on with the slides for the moment. If you can move on to slide 19, please. Then we had a question about how do you validate a message against the schema and still have the ability to control the message direction so you can send a good or bad response message. So moving on to question slide 20, then one way of doing this is using the devalidate node. So once your message flow is in, your message flow has parsed the message and you've got an input tree, once you go down the out terminal of an input node, you can either turn validation on at the input node, at which point if it fails validation, it would go down the failure terminal of that input node, which you may not want to do. So if halfway on your message flow you want to validate your message, you can then use the validate node. And the validate node has match and failure terminals. Obviously, if the node validates the message against a model, then it will go down the match terminal. And if it fails to validate against the model, it will go down the failure terminal. So you can use this to validate messages in the XMLSC and MOM domains, so domains which you have a message set for. And you can select the message set, the type, the format, the bits you want to validate against. And you can also select what the type of validation you want, whether you want sort of a content composition type of validation where it will just check your message against the model, or whether you want that kind of validation, the composition validation, a GAN value as well. So it will check the composition of the message and the values in those fields. And I think one of the key bits here is the validation failure mode. So the different failure modes here are quite useful. So user trace or local error log will just keep a record of the validation failures, but won't actually affect your flow. You'll be able to continue down the flow. And then exception and exception list will actually interrupt the message flow. So with exception, if you fail to validate your message, then we'll stop validating at the first validation failure and propagate down the failure terminal. And then you can choose to handle that as you want. But with exception list, then we will keep, after we have a first validation phase, we will keep and retry and validate some more. And then every time we hit a validation error, we will populate the exception list with another entry for the validation failure. So if you've got several different things in your message that you want to check, so you want to check different values in different fields,
and they all failed, then you'll end up with lots of events in the exception list that say we failed to validate those bits, and then we will propagate down the failure terminal. So that's a good way to actually validate an entire message, is to use the exception list validation failure mode option. So one thing worth pointing out and just mentioning quickly is that if the incoming bitstream is not well formed and can't be parsed, then we can't validate it against the model. So we have to be able to parse it to be able to validate it against the model. So if you've got XML and it's got some characters that aren't valid in XML in the incoming bitstream, then we will fail to parse it and we won't be able to validate it. So I've just touched on a few points there for validation. Okay, so I think one question here is, we've had is, how can you capture an invalid response from a SOAP request node? So if a SOAP, you send out a SOAP request and the client sends back a SOAP fault message, then we will go down the fault terminal and you'll be able to handle that, and that's what we'd recommend there. But I wonder if that is also meaning about the actual format of the response message that comes back from the remote web service that can't be parsed. I believe at that point we'll go down the failure terminal of the SOAP request message, the SOAP request node, and at that point you'll have an exception list populated with the errors of why we can't parse it, and you'll be able to handle that because you'll have the bitstream as well.
Okay, I'd like to take a few of these as well. With one of the questions you had, what are the limitations of the Java compute node vis-a-vis the Java language itself? Can I do everything that I can do within Java in a Java compute node? The answer is mostly. We don't put any restrictions on the Java code other than it must be re-entrant and thread safe. Other than that, you can do almost anything you can do in Java within the Java compute node. Obviously, you're restricted to the JRE level you ship with the product, which at 7 is 1.6. And you're also restricted with certain classes that we rely on internally. So things like the Xerxes XML parser, you can cause conflicts trying to use particular versions of those parsers. However, these can usually be resolved by proper class path setup. So someone asked, if I have a compute node, a Java compute node, and WTX node in a message flow, what's the best common logging mechanism that can write trace, debug, and error level logs to a common log file? Certainly in terms of a compute node and Java compute node, I'd be looking at log4j here. You can call that statically through ESQL. I don't know if you can call Java directly from the WTX maps. You can certainly call it prior to launching a WTX map from the Java WTX API, but I'm afraid I'd have to defer you to someone from a WTX team to answer that in any more depth from WTX perspective.
With that as well, from Java and from ESQL, you can also log out to the syslog. There's APIs available to do that inside of Message Broker, which is also another place to record errors.
And the last question I've seen there is, how to avoid duplicate record processing with the file input node when reading record by record mode when the file has 10 records and has failed at the fifth record. When the flow is restarted, is it going to start processing again from the first record, or is it going to start from the fifth record? The answer is the file input node will start from the beginning. However, at version 7 fixed pack 2, we introduced the file read node. Now, in the file read node, you can specify an offset within the file to start your processing from. So if you've detected a failure at a certain record, you can set the offset to skip past that when you run your retry logic. Finally, we also have, which is better performance-wise, ESQL or Java. It really depends a lot on what you're doing. ESQL can access the parse trees directly, so it's going to be much faster for doing navigation of the parse tree or doing any kind of parsing. Java, you have a lot of inbuilt functions that aren't available in ESQL that you'd have to implement yourself, and I think you probably get performance gains there doing things that are part of the Java standard class library.
And then one final question was, do we have a command to report the status of message flows if it is currently stopped or started through the command line? So actually at version 7, we have taken that request on board, and version 7 of Message Broker MQSI list pointed at a broker as an execution group, and it will tell you the flows that are there, the status of them, whether they're stopped or running, and any other details depending on the detail level you select. So we have taken that request on board. We've had numerous times, and at version 7, MQSI List can actually do that from the command line.
Okay, so I think we're going to push on with the slides now, so if we could move on to slide 21, please. Okay, so the question we were submitted is, what approaches are available to cache data from a database across flows in an execution group? If we could move on to 22. So the usual approach for caching data is shared row variables in ESQL. These don't satisfy the requirement in the question, but I thought it was worth mentioning as they're very much a traditional way of doing things across multiple instances of the same flow. This is a facility provided built into the product, and you can initialize the variable once in an atomic block and then read it from multiple threads. When you do updates to a shared row variable, you must also do this under atomic block. The write option itself is atomic, but the tree operation is not, so you need to do all your updates under atomic block. The second way is to write a Java class with either static methods or static members to hold your data. This is visible to the whole execution group, and in fact, if you use the named class loaders feature we introduced with version 7, you could actually control the scope of that cache to be finer grained if you wanted to. This does require your application code to handle the locking and the synchronization, but Java's facilities are very well documented and fairly easy to use, and it does provide the finest grain control. This is the method I would probably recommend if you have good Java skills in-house. If we move on to slide 23, there we go, just a slight delay there. If you don't have good Java skills, we actually have support pack IA91, which is the cache nodes. These are basically a Java implementation of a cache. They can be used at an intra-flow, intra-EG, or even an intra-broker level, and the locking is handled automatically for you. They're available as nodes in the flow, so you could use them in a no-coding solution, just routing your message through. And you can also call into the cache via some ESQL methods that they provide. You do need to take some care with your flow control path to make sure you don't do any multiple initialization unnecessarily. But if you don't have strong Java skills, these are a really good option. And if we could move on to the next slide, please. Okay, so slide 24, I was going to talk about WebSphere Extreme Scale, which isn't really a cache. It's more an alternative to using a traditional database for this style of information. We're seeing a few customers start to use this because it can be distributed around multiple WAS clusters, and they can then call out using a client API inside the Java compute node. This will let you share cache between flows, EGs, brokers, or even unrelated applications, but it does, of course, add additional infrastructure components. So that might be something to think about if you're looking at an entire infrastructure approach to caching data.
So there's a couple of questions here whilst we wait for the slides to come back. What is the best way to handle HTTP timeout messages when the flow is exposed as a web service? So in version 7, I think it's 6-pack 1 or 6-pack 2, we added a timeout terminal to the SOAP input node and I believe the HTTP input nodes. And so these will these timeout terminals will get fired if a request is not handled in time by the flow. And then you're given, I think, 10 extra seconds to actually perform some logic and then process that and reply in before we send back a default timeout response. So there are now options in with the HTTP input and the SOAP input node to actually handle timeouts on your incoming web service request.
Okay, we've also had a question asking what is the best option for outbound file transfer by FTP from a message flow without using a Java compute node? And the answer to that is the file output node. It supports both FTP and SFTP. It does not support FTPS, which is the FTP protocol over SSL.
And another question there, is there any built-in functionality to retry the SOAP, retry from the SOAP input node? No, the SOAP input node there is no retry mechanism on the SOAP input node for HTTP. For JMS, there is a backout count if you're in SOAP over JMS, and you can then retry a SOAP over JMS message. of HTTP, it would be up to the client to resubmit that request. However, you could code some logic in your flow on the out terminal of the SOAP input node that would catch exceptions and retry if you wanted to do that.
And the last question I've just seen is, how can we refresh those cache nodes? You'll have to refer to the documentation for the specifics, but I believe the approach is that you can clear the cache or put and get from the cache from the nodes. So if you wanted to clear it, you'd have to build that into your flow control logic. Okay, I do see there's one more question there, which we will get to. I think I'm going to push through into the next question on the slides first. And that's question 7 on slide 25, which is, are there any guidelines on handling large messages in Broker? And if we could move straight on to slide 26. Okay, so the challenge with handling large messages that we see mostly is the amount of memory it takes. And this has actually, ironically, in some ways got worse with us moving to 64-bit execution groups, because we now have available much more address space, and it allows the execution group to take up a lot more memory than it did before. And the key to the memory usage is that the parse tree can be much larger than the input or output message. The parse tree in memory actually has to store the structure of the message along with any type information. Additionally, when it does have data associated with it, it stores that data in UCS2, and that requires twice as many bytes per character as most input and output code pages. In addition, it also has to store namespace information and other internal housekeeping information that we use for tree navigation. So basically, with an appreciation of those factors, you can sort of see why some people come in saying, well, I've sent a 10 megabyte message, why is it taking up 50 or 60 or more megabytes in memory? And the reason is because by the time it gets into a form which we can perform parsing and navigation into, it can actually be quite a lot bigger. So moving on to slide 27. When you have batch data, it's best to try and split early before you even enter the flow logic if possible. So a lot of our nodes are added at 6.1, the TCP IP nodes and the file nodes in particular have a records and elements feature. This basically allows you to parse out a single record, and that record is treated as a message and propagated down the flow. Now, the advantage of this is your single record is much, much smaller than the entire message, and you only ever have to hold that single record in memory at once. If you cannot split using records and elements, say you're using an input node that doesn't support that feature, you could consider pre-processing in the block domain to divide up into records which you can process individually. That will mean you do have to hold the entire input bit stream in memory at once, but when you actually parse it and build the parse trees, which are much, much bigger, you can do that one at a time. So moving on to slide 28. So we have documented a few advanced processing techniques that you might be able to use where you don't have batch data that's easy to split up. Now, the idea behind both these techniques is to, again, copy an input bitstream to an area in the environment tree and then try to parse out only certain bits of it at once and then delete the bits you finished with before you move on to parsing. And that allows you to control how much of the tree is in memory at any one time. They're quite long documents, so I haven't gone into them in any detail here, but I've referenced links to that for both the XML and the MRM tree. Where possible, use references and bitstream copies to minimize the amount of parse trees held in memory at one time. And again, as well as minimizing the size of individual parse trees, you can cut down on the number of parse trees by ensuring you pass through the minimum number of nodes possible, and particularly compute nodes where you set output root equal to input root. That will perform a tree copy and will give you two copies of the same parse tree, which doubles your memory usage. So where possible, you should minimize that. And you can do that by setting the propagation mode in compute nodes to propagate only the local environment or only the environment where you don't need the message itself. Okay, we could move on to slide 29. You can see I just covered slide 29 earlier. This is where I was talking again. Don't propagate the message tree unless you have to. Minimize the number of nodes and avoid doing input route equals output route an excessive number of times. So moving right on to, I think, slide 30. So as I said, the biggest challenge with large messages is memory. So aside from the flow design, one of the things you can do is ensure your system is set up to find access to memory. So you can do that by setting the U-limit settings on Unix platforms. If you're still using 32-bit EGs, perhaps on 6.1, then there are environment variables which you can use to set the amount of memory available. I've given the AIX one there. There are other variables you can use on other platforms. If your messages are big, you'll often have to alter the default message size on your queues and channels for your MQ message infrastructure. Otherwise, you'll get MQRCs coming back when you actually try to send the messages anywhere. The other thing with large messages is if you have to write them anywhere, it takes a long time, and I/O is quite slow compared to computing and processing. So if you don't have to log the entire message bitstream, then don't. Logging it away to a file or a queue or a database is only going to slow down your flow. And if that message is hundreds of megabytes in size, or you know, perhaps even getting onto gigabytes in size, you're really going to reduce your throughput considerably. And that ties in with what Dave was talking about with monitoring as well.
So I think this, before we move on to the next set of slides, we'll just wrap up some questions we've been asked. So is there any calendar-based, time-based scheduling with the timer node? So with the timer node, you can use the timeout control node, and in that node you can actually specify a time and date that you want an event emitted from your timeout node. You can't specify to do it every day, but you can specify a certain date and time which you want a timeout node to actually go off. So if you look at the timeout control node there for more information. Is the batch data feature available for the MQ input node? Unfortunately not. At the moment, it's only available for the file input node, the record reads option, and the TCPIP nodes. And on flows with a commit count greater than 1, how do I know which message in a bunch caused an error? At the moment, the answer is that you don't, by us. Yeah, you'd have to keep your own record of how many times you've actually seen a message or how many times through the commit count you are. I think that would be a good requirement that you could raise that would say how many group messages in a group have I sort of processed, and we could keep an account in the local environment or the environment, something like that. I think that would be a good requirement to raise there. So is it possible to schedule a flow to trigger every day at the same time? So I think that leads on with the timeout control node question. You could possibly write something that would either schedule lots of events into the timeout control node, or you put one message in, the timeout control node would schedule events for the next day, and then whilst processing that message that comes out the next day, it schedules again for the following day. That's essentially something you could code up there to do that.
Okay. Nick also asked, how would you suggest handling a requirement to implement PubSub using files instead of messages? My client wants to read a single file and create several output files, each with different content filter rules. Now, I think you have two obvious approaches here. You could build the PubSub logic yourself into the flow and use the local environment overrides to set the destination data for the output files. That's quite a lot of effort, and I'd probably be inclined to use Broker instead to subscribe on behalf of everyone who wants to receive the file and then write a flow to process that subscription, that publication rather, into a file that can be consumed by the client that needs the file output. So the last question was, can we stop a message flow processing a file if the file is larger than the expected size? There is a environment variable you can use. I'll look it up and reply into the chat. But I'm going to hand over to, I think, Randy, who's going to answer the next question.
Okay, the next question that was submitted is, how do I take advantage of the new capability in version 7 to set up unique environments for each ZOS broker execution group? Just a bit of background here first, I suppose, to go along with that, is that prior to version 7, 6 Pack 2, All execution groups use the same environment file as the main broker task used, and in most cases that was fine. However, we had seen in a few cases where it might be beneficial to be able to specify a unique environment for a particular execution group based upon, you know, the actual processing that it was doing. So that sort of was the premise for how this requirement sort of came to light. So beginning with version 7 fixed pack 2, each execution group can have its own execution, or rather can have its own environment file for greater flexibility related to the loaded content that it gets, the runtime options that it has, as well as the environment variables that it processes. And this can include things such as, or related to debugging and tracing and such, as how it sort of ties into this presentation today. So given that, can we have the next slide, number 32, please? Okay. So some of the points that I had made just previously were the previous foil, so that's fine. Now, so the way that this all works is that if you, within the BitGen process, or member rather, if you actually add some particular references to some execution group label files, all right, then when you run the BitGen process, it actually will create execution group level environment files. So as you might imagine, when you run the process, several files can be produced. One would be for the main task and any execution groups that weren't specified in the BitGen member. Okay, and then there'd be a file or an execution group environment file for each of the execution groups that was specified in BitGen. Okay, so the thing to keep in mind is that variables set in the execution group level profile, all right, take precedence over those in the general environment file. So the only thing that would really need to be in the execution group profile would be things that you want to add or to overwrite from sort of the main broker profile. Okay? So setting execution group specific environments can reduce the overall impact on system resources in various environments. Okay? And we find it particularly helpful when we're working with customers doing flow debugging and whatnot, and there's load issues where we need to basically collect trace information on the initial loading of things. And we can do that more easily now at the execution group level as opposed to setting it at the broker level, and then when the broker would start having all execution groups traced, now we can more easily manage a single execution group, and there's quite a bit less impact on the system when doing that. So that's the significance of execution group level environment files and environments, and they can be tuned to, you know, based upon the nature of the processing that you're doing, and they can also be set to collect particular debug information and not have to set it at a system-wide basis. So that covers this particular question. I think I'd like to turn it over to Rao next to handle question number 535.
Thank you. Based on the number of queries that we received, I thought of addressing the sample question that was posted earlier slightly different in a different way. But what are the limitations that we need to understand in implementing the message flows in the multi-instance brokers? That's the first question. And the second one is, are there any additional advantages with multi-instances on top of HACNP or a commercially available cluster software solution? Slide number 35, please. The first one, the multi-instance broker failover happens via the MQ transport, and thus the other transport failovers, I mean the automatic reconnections, are not currently supported. For message flow which use JMS or SOAP input nodes would need a network dispatcher like mod proxy balancer or data power or any other software or hardware solutions in front of multi-instance message brokers containing hosts for redirecting the traffic to the failed over host address system. The HTTP servlets won't help in connecting to the host with the standby node when it gets active during the failover. The proxy servlets can optionally use the MQ client connection. However, with the existing limitations in the code, servlets won't be able to have multiple client connections That's the reason why the servlets won't be able to work even for active-active configurations as well. The next slide, please. So the multi-instance clustering concept is different from what the WebSphere product is currently offering, as some users tend to draw parallels while understanding. The type of options that, like defining multiple code by IAOP URLs in JMS provider definitions that WebSphere currently offers won't work here. That should help in reconnecting the applications during the failover in WASP clusters. The other limitations I want to bring in the next slide is the shared library folder in WAR MQSI. Since the WAR MQSI file system is not going to be failed over to the standby node during the failover process, the best practice is to have a copy of library files in both nodes of the cluster and have this folder created in the shared NFS file system so that it's available for both active and standby nodes. In slide 38, if we go. Yeah. Generally speaking, the multi-instance brokers provide only a subset of the capabilities of the commercial cluster software like HSEMP, and it won't give any additional benefits. If the failover time can be broken into two sections like detection and component start, the detection is often quicker in the multi-instances, while the component start takes more or less the same for both the HSEMP and the multi-instances. The commercial clusters will need extra time when compared to the multi-instances for failing over the file systems and IP addresses. The rate determining factor for failovers in multi-instances is the size of the MQ logs. And except the fast failover, the multi-instances will not provide any extra benefits. But in spite of that, some users would want to create a multi-instances in HSEMP like clusters. They can go ahead and create the brokers with the minus E flag to point to the shared file system. And then, next slide, please. Once created, one has to use them in a normal way with the HSEMP clustered broker having active broker process in the active node, while there won't be any secondary process running on the passive cluster node. So in a cluster environment, in a cluster HSEMP cluster environment, we won't see any processes running actively on the secondary or the backup node, just like how we see in multi-instances environment. Some users have been asking for if message brokers can be configured to use active-active mode. The answer is no, and it cannot be. Next slide, please.
So thank you, Ralph, and thank you to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for live Q&A period.
Hi, there's a couple of other questions we'd like to answer that have been submitted on the actual chat.
Yes.
Do you want to go first, Tim? Dave's lost his question. One of the questions was, how do I get the retry count if I opted for the retry option on the DB input or the file input nodes? Unfortunately, we don't think there is a count that's kept in the local environment or the environment automatically by the node at the moment. That would make a good requirement, though, again. But you could keep a count yourself in the environment, or you could update a data flow or a shared row variable, something like that. You could keep a count there.
But another question was, is there a best practice to determine how many brokers or execution groups to be created for a distributed environment? And the answer to that is there is no number as such. It will always depend on the resources available on the machine. Usually when you're creating lots of brokers and you've got lots of execution groups, the main issue is memory. So you would need to make sure that you have sufficient real memory installed on the machine. It's no good having swap space or paging space. You actually need real memory to support all the execution groups that you would want up at one time. Really, you know, one broker, many brokers to support the same number of execution groups is really sort of ease of administration. So it's easier to manage one broker with 30 execution groups rather than, you know, three brokers each with 10 execution groups. So often, you know, companies work such that, you know, maybe different lines of business have their own broker. So there are different reasons why you might want to go down the one or multi-broker image, path. But really, you just need to make sure that there are the resources there, primarily memory, as I say, but also CPU, because there's no point in putting too much work onto a machine, you know, that just doesn't have the resources to run all the work you would want it to do.
Okay, I was going to answer Deepika's question, which is, when I do PSAUX for the data flow engine, a particular EG shows memory utilization as 342 megabytes, but the JVM max heap size for that EG is only 256 megabytes. What does the memory given on the PSAUX command account for? And the answer is that Message Broker uses native memory and Java memory. So Java, as you may know, allocates its own heap within the parent process's native heap. And that can be much smaller than the memory that Message Broker is using natively. And in fact, all of the message tree is stored in the native heap. So generally, we'd expect to see the native heap driving memory usage much more than the Java heap size, unless you're doing particularly heavy Java work. You can use tools like the Java Health Center, which will tell you your current Java heap size. And you can also see that with resource statistics in MBX.
The other thing is also that unless you set min to max heap size, there will be a difference from that on the Java.
Oh, that's true, actually, yeah. So unless you set the min to the max heap size, then the min is normally 32 meg, I believe. So you actually start off with a 32 meg JVM, and then over time, as Java memory usage increases, it will grow to the 256 meg JVM size.
Okay, Barris has asked, going back to batch mode for file nodes, even though the processing stops at the first error in the file, the partial files created in the MKSI transit folder are not deleted. Is there a way to get rid of these automatically? And there isn't a way to get rid of them automatically. And the reason for that is that the file nodes are not transactional. All of their operations are outside transactions. So, for example, if you're using a file input node to split a large file up into lots of small records, then if you write those records out with the file output node, the write happens as soon as you finish processing in that node. And anything that happens later on in the flow can't remove those. There's no automatic facility at the moment for doing that yourself. The only thing I could suggest is that you might want to use something like a trigger file so you can trigger when all of the records have been processed without a exception or something like that.
We do have a question on the phone. Would you like to take that?
Yeah. Well,
okay. From John Arnold, your line is open.
Hi. How do we throw a user exception in a Java compute node similar to eSQL throw statement? How do we throw an exception from Java compute?
There is a class, I think it's MB broker exception class, and we're just looking that up. You can actually throw an exception in a Java compute node.
And we tried that. I mean, we couldn't initialize the class.
Just bear with us a moment. We'll just bring up the API.
And then no further questions on the phone.
Okay, I think we're going to move on while Dave's looking that one up. So Deepika says, each time we configure a user data source entry on odbc.ne and use MKSI setdb params to set user and password, we need to cycle the broker to take that into effect. Can this be avoided? And the answer is no, not at the current time, unfortunately.
Yes, that would make a good requirement.
Yes, that would make a very good requirement. Arvind also says, what is the easiest way to increase or decrease the message flow instances at runtime based on the transaction volume? Now, the key part here is in order to increase or decrease the number of additional instances available, you need to deploy the flow, which is going to temporarily stop the flow while you're processing. So one thing you probably want to avoid is trying to increase the additional instances during times of peak load. And in fact, if you do have more additional instances than you need, the thread model will make sure that you're not running them all the time. If you only have one message going through every hour, then it will spin up one thread to deal with that message. It won't be running all sort of 100 additional instances at once. If you do still want to, like maybe you can predict your load very easily and you still want to make changes to the instances based on transaction volume, then you could actually use a message flow calling the CMP API to do that. Or in fact, even an external application calling the CMP API.
We have another question that prompted. Would you like to take that now?
Yeah, go ahead.
From Titus Anthony, your line is open.
The validate node, can it reference an external schema?
No. No, it would have to. The validate node would have to reference a message set or schema, message set deployed to into the execution group which the message flow is running in.
So what do you guys suggest? We have a we are using a plugin node which is wrote in back in version 5. It's using Java plugin node to validate a XML message, and it's behind the scenes is using a search parser. So how we can replace that plugin node with the latest functionality in version 7?
So I think the XSLT node will do what you want.
XSLT node, can it be validate a message? I think it's doing a transformation using XSL.
We'd have to look in more detail at what the Java plugin node does at v5, I think, before we can advise there, unfortunately.
So whom should we need to talk?
You can write to us, and we will see how best we can help you out.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a follow-up question about the number of additional instances, which is in V7 Plus, we can change the number of instances from the MV Explorer. Would that redeploy or restart the flow? And the answer is yes, it does.
Yeah.
And below that, we have a question, does changing the CSD or fixed back level need a flow or execution group restart? And the answer is you need to restart the whole broker. So again, another follow-up question on the additional instances. Is that a redeploy or a restart? And the answer is that a redeploy and a restart are actually very similar from an internal point of view of the actual message flow itself. So there's not really any meaningful difference between them. In terms of what happens, the whole flow gets deconstructed in memory and then reconstructed.
Dan, there's also another question. Does a change to a Java code require flow, e.g. broker restart? Did you answer that? I don't think we did. So you can if you deploy your jar file, then you can redeploy a jar file, but that will restart any flows that use a Java compute node or instances inside that jar file.
It does do it for you automatically, though. You don't have to explicitly yourself stop the flow.
Thank you, everyone, for your participation in the live Q&A period. At this point in time, I would like to move on to slide number 41 and pass the presentation over to David for a summary of today's session.
Hi, well, thank you all for attending. I think we've all been surprised at the number of questions and requests we've got, and also the quality of the questions. We hope we've managed to answer some of the common pitfalls and problems that we see people encountering in the field when they're looking at their message flow design. Due to time constraints, we have had to sort of take quite a broad approach to answering these. But if you do need to dive into more depth, then we provide some references for you to go through at your leisure. But do feel free to get in touch with IBM and ask your questions. Joseph can forward any that are related to the presentation to us via the WSE help email address that he gave you earlier. And I just once again like to thank you all for attending.
Thank you, David, for a great summary. At this point in time, we will conclude the Ask the Expert session.